bleak skies for amber waves of green.
Well, good evening. Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, here the evening before the 4th of July, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls. We have with us right now on the line from back east. Is it from Kansas City? Joe Foreman, whereabouts is it? Toledo?
Yeah, it's Topeka, Kansas.
Well, I know of someplace down there in the Midwest. And, of course, Joe is with a very unusual organization. It's called MediShare. And when I first heard of this, I'll have to admit I was a little concerned because I know about some of these Christian sharing healthcare programs. But you know what? I checked this one out, knowing people who actually have it. And then, of course, we checked with the American Evangelistic Association, which is the parent organization for this. And the American Evangelistic Association's been around. How long have they been around?
Since 1954.
Well, that's a good long time. That's almost 50 years. So why don't you tell us a little bit about MediShare and really what it is and, of course, what a great program it is.
Okay. Well, MediShare is the result of Christians beginning to figure out that we've been living in a society and paying for medical insurance where roughly 80% of the claims that are occurring in America are lifestyle abuse. And you know, it's more, Dr. Stan, it's more than just tobacco, drugs, alcohol, AIDS, sexually transmitted, abortion, and other things. It's things like obesity and people living just a lawless life when it comes to food. You know, the saying is that more and more nutritionists are saying that we feed our dogs and cats better than we feed our fellow human beings. Because we feed the dogs and cats a Hill's Science Diet or whatever dog food company you work with, and it's got all the proteins and all the vitamins and minerals that they know that dogs and cats need. But when it comes to human beings, we like to eat white processed flour foods, no fiber. The nutrients are gone. And it's showing up in the American populace with unbelievable cancer rates and heart disease. Obesity is a national disgrace here because we eat these foods that, for one thing, they don't have the nutrients in them and they don't have the fiber, so we don't get the satiety that we need, and so we just keep eating and eating and eating, and so the result is just not very good.
All right, fine. So basically, MediShare was originally a sort of a health ministry or a means of taking care of the employees of the American Evangelistic Association and their missionaries, wasn't it?
Yes, and they found that they could take care of their fellow missionaries and pastors, at a fraction of the cost versus just going out and buying health insurance. And that's what's happened. We have over 40,000 individuals in our program, and you know, our single members, pay, regardless of age, are paying just $120 a month. Our couples are paying $230 a month for their monthly share, and then families of three people or more, whether there's three or 13 or 23, doesn't matter, and regardless of age, it's less than $300. It's $297 a month. And for that, we have a $250 deductible and then 100% sharing to $5 million. So if I have something happen to me, whether it's a $12,000 broken leg or a $200,000 cancer treatment, I've got the first $250, and then my brothers and sisters in this program, they take care of 100% from there to $5 million.
Well, you know, there have been all sorts of various ways that this has worked, and I know that there have been some groups, and, you know, of course, if somebody was ill, then they'd say to somebody else, well, now you send them your money for this month, and so many people will send them the money to pay for that. But that's really not how yours works at all. Basically, how are you different from an insurance company? How does your system work?
Okay, well, and as you pointed out, we are different from an insurance company. We are actually very clear and very careful to really make sure that people understand that we are not an insurance company. What we are is a fellowship of over 40,000 Christians who've come together according to the biblical mandate of Galatians 6:2 to take care of each other's medical bills. And so we are a fellowship using our religious freedoms and our right of association to take care of each other according to what our religious faith tells us that we should be doing.
But of course, now, what people do is they send in so much money every month to you, depending upon what category they are, single, double, or a family. And then, of course, you take that money, and you simply take the money. It doesn't go into a fund. It doesn't go into real estate. You don't have a big fund. You simply take the money in, and you put the money out. There might be a little money left over one month and go out the next one. Mm-hmm. But, of course, it's backed up by a catastrophic insurance policy. Would you like to cover that? Because I think, you know, when you begin talking about some of the health care bills today, which are so ridiculous, people really want to know that this is a really viable alternative.
Well, you know, Dr. Stan, you're right. I mean, in today's world, we could have a spinal cord injury go $3 million, $4 million, or whatever. I mean, it's pretty amazing, pretty exotic what can happen. But so for that reason, we felt that rather than expose our sharing program to the possibility that we'd get hit with a couple of these gigantic claims, what we do is we take care of the first 50,000 in-house, and that's our sharing program. And then if someone has a huge bill that goes over 50,000, at that point we send it to the insurance company that we contract with. And so and there, you know, we do shop that every year, but usually we're with the same company about 3 years. They step in, of course, and they take care of the bill from 50,000 and they guarantee it all the way to 5 million.
All right. So now I think it's important that people understand that this is not open to everybody. Why don't you tell, the requirements to actually join the organization?
Mm-hmm. Okay. To qualify, one must be a born-again Christian and not use tobacco, drugs, or alcohol. So there'd be no tobacco use or obviously drug use. Alcohol is permitted in moderation, but obviously the abuse thereof would not be permitted.
All right, but how do you know what they're doing?
Okay, well, first of all, when they apply, they have to have a pastor or an elder, spiritual leader at the church where they attend. And then, by the way, they do, as a born-again Christian, they do have to attend church regularly. And the pastor needs to vouch for them that, yes, he believes them to be sincere, Bible-believing Christians, living a reasonably biblical lifestyle, obviously not using tobacco or abusing alcohol or obviously not using drugs and not involved in immorality. And then if they get involved in any of those things, they simply that we would not participate in their medical bills. For example, someone would go to the hospital, one of our members, they find nicotine in their blood, or in their system somehow, and then we would just simply not participate. Because the rules going in are you cannot use tobacco and be in our program.
All right, well, that certainly is a... and this gives you a certain advantage over a general, health care insurance program. And then, of course, there are certain diseases that you won't cover, or at least that have to be brought under control before you will. What are those?
Okay, for example, now we're really speaking about qualifying to get into the program. Is that what
you
were saying?
Right.
Okay, for example, because of the insurance company that backs us up, they have a guideline book that we really have to go by, and they do not accept diabetics, although it's my understanding that in the past, when we've had a type 2 diabetic that wanted to join, if he was willing to reverse that diabetes, and we know that there are many clinics around the country, and some of them are what we call lifestyle nutrition centers. Weimar, the world famous Weimar Institute right there in California is a good example. They are reversing diabetes, getting people off insulin. I mean, they're reversing type 2, obviously. Type 1 is not reversible at this point. But if those folks will reverse that diabetes, they will be accepted into our program.
All right, fine. And I think that this is really what's so significant is that you have, of course, a wellness program. You can't force anybody to get involved with it, but it is there. And this was really what amazed me about the entire program. Weimar is an institute that, well, we've had them on our program in years past, and they take people, and well, why don't you explain what Weimar does? Because it is really, to me, it's one of the most exciting things. And then, of course, your approach to using Weimar, at least in California, or other similar institutions throughout the world, to try to counter, you know, if, for instance, you're in the program and you do develop a type 2 diabetes, or, you know, so what are you going to do? Or you're going to need a coronary bypass. You go to your doctor and he says, terrible, you know, you've got 19 clogged arteries and you're going to die if you don't have this operation. So what's your approach under these circumstances?
Okay, well, you know, when someone is with a secular insurance, and let's say, to use your example, they come down with chest pain, they go to the cardiologist, and he says, you know, well, you've got this unbelievable blockage, and you're not going to live without a hard bypass. Well, you know, when you're with a secular insurance company, bingo, you're just going to be on that operating table, and the policyholders will then be faced with having to, at the next renewal, of course, to pay for that $100,000 bypass or whatever it is. And I know there's a big range. I mean, it may range from anywhere like $40,000 to $200,000, I mean, depending on how exotic. But in our case, you know, people are always asking, well, Joe, this sounds great, but how in the world do you do this at less than $300 a month, even for a family of 55 that still has children? Now, how do you do it? Well, one of the ways that we do this, of course, is we take that person who's got the chest pain, and if he's not in immediate danger, we encourage him to go to one of the lifestyle nutrition centers. There's about 10 of them around the country that we work with. The Weimar Institute is obviously one of the better known. And for example, they will send this individual there, a guy who couldn't, when he arrived, couldn't walk around the flagpole twice without chest pain. And, you know, inside of less than 3 weeks, they've got this gentleman walking 4, 5, 6 miles a day with no chest pain.
All right, and, of course, this is diet, exercise, just a complete transformation of the lifestyle, because coronary artery disease is reversible. And now, of course, the question is, how bad is he? How do you know whether, of course, he's going to be in any acute danger when he calls and says, look, you know, my doctor says I've got to have this done right away.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you do then?
Okay, well, we've got on staff. We've got quite a wellness department, very well-trained people, but we do have two Christian MDs on staff that are trained to really be able to ascertain. And, of course, this would not be my bailiwick. I wouldn't know how to, in fact, I would not want to be in the position of counseling someone, but the individual in question will be interviewed by one of our MDs, and together they'll make a decision. And, you know, in so many cases, so far we've not ever had a problem with sending one of our members to a lifestyle nutrition center in lieu of getting them on the table for the heart bypass. So it's worked out so very well, and everyone who's done it has just been elated. You know, they virtually require that, let's say the man's the one that's come down with a chest pain, they virtually require that his wife go with him to the lifestyle nutrition center. And so she not only takes the classes and does the physical exercise and learns from the physiologist there, but also she takes the cooking classes so that she can learn how to prepare really delicious meals that are extremely effective as far as helping to reverse that coronary artery disease. And so it's a whole man approach, and the way we look at it, instead of paying $100,000 for a temporary cure, We're paying, our members are sharing about 6 to 7 and maybe 8,000 for a permanent cure, because we're giving the person a whole new lifestyle.
Well, of course, I think the significant thing is that if you have a coronary bypass, and if you don't change your life after that and give up certain foods and exercise, why those arteries are going to clog up again. In other words,
absolutely.
What the surgery does is temporarily alleviate the problem, but of course, it's going to come back again without a total lifestyle change. And what you're suggesting is a total lifestyle change. Now, what really surprised me is that, you know, these are people who are in the program, they've been there for a time, and you pick up the expense of this, which is be quite an outlay for many people.
Mm-hmm. And of course, most people could probably afford $5,000 or $6,000 instead of, and virtually no one can afford $100,000 unless they're extremely wealthy. But you know, it's like I say, it is a whole man approach, and it's kind of, you know, sometimes we could get discouraged that we have people that have that are in our program and they've been getting our newsletter and they see and read all this stuff about how they need to be living a proper lifestyle, getting vegetables and fruit and whole grain and getting vigorous exercise, and they still may come down with chest pain. Well, the truth of the matter is, some people, until they hit that crisis, they just don't take all this stuff really as seriously as they ought. But, you know, we have found the results have been extremely good with sending them to these lifestyle nutrition centers, and we're just saving our people a lot of money by doing it that way.
And in the long run, of course, you're saving the whole system. So mm-hmm. This is really what makes it different than others. And, of course, you know, when the HMOs first came in, and, oh, they always had the slogan, preventative medicine, we want to keep people well. But how do they keep you well? Why, of course, they gave you this questionnaire to fill out. And, of course, that questionnaire was really, in many instances, was so they can keep you out of the HMO.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as prevention is concerned, really, of course, changing the lifestyle is up to the individual now. But what happens if somebody says, no, I'd rather get the coronary bypass?
Well, you know, if they insist and they just believe that that's the way to go, then we, of course, we will take care of a coronary heart bypass.
All right.
Obviously, we hope our members are willing to you know, be educated in this area and see that there is a better way. But, you know, some people, they're just afraid of anything new.
All right, fine. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment for our guest, Joe Foreman, why don't you go ahead and give us a call? Because he certainly understands this better than I do. But I do, I've had the opportunity since the first time I had Joe onto our program to check it out, to check with the American Evangelistic Association. And this is really a tried and true method. Now, how long has this been open, the program been open to people outside of ministers and the missionaries?
Dr. Sand, since 1993. So we've just hit our 10th anniversary, you know, by which we've been opened up to the general Christian public. And before that, it was restricted to just the pastors and missionaries of the American Evangelistic Association.
And, of course, when something comes up and, of course, your costs go up, then, of course, you're going to have to increase the fees. You do that once a year. But I thought it was so interesting this last year you didn't have to increase the fees at all, did you?
That is correct. We've stayed level here. You know, and that is doubly encouraging in the face of the medical inflation that is happening out there. I mean, you know, the rest of the economy, the inflation is pretty low, but the medical inflation has never really slowed. It just keeps roaring ahead every year. And so while insurance companies are increasing their rates by 20, 30, 50%, whatever, we were able to stay level this year. In fact, over the last 10 years, our average annual increase is 4.5%. And when you look at the fact that medical inflation has been out there really past 10%, I think probably averaging more like 12 or even more percent a year, we feel like God is just really blessed. Obviously, our medical utilization per capita is going down in order for us to only go up 4.5 when the rates are going up 10 or more percent in the economy as a whole on the medical front.
And of course, we upped our note here in California. The Blue Cross policy we have for my wife went up dramatically this last year. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, give us a call at 888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Our guest is Joe Foreman. The organization that he's with is called MediShare, and we'll be back here in just a few moments, and I look forward to your calls. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Joe Foreman with MediShare. And, of course, this is really the best way, you know, at least some people get the good insurance through their employer. But then, of course, when somebody else is paying for it, there's really no incentive for you to really to try to improve your health, to alter your diet. And, of course, we found out, and if you really study the medical literature, which most people don't, on nutrition, because doctors, you know, if you're a surgeon, you're going to be reading about surgery, and if you're an ophthalmologist, you're going to be reading about ophthalmological surgery, and an obstetrician's going to be reading in his field. But, you know, if you begin to study certainly nutrition, you find out that it really does make a difference. There are many cancers that can be prevented or cut down considerably by eating proper foods. Certainly our body will be benefited by proper vitamins and minerals. And you get into all that sort of thing in these regular, as a monthly magazine that you send out to your subscribers?
Yes. You know, every other month we do have a newsletter where we are sharing testimonies of people who made changes in their diet, and in many cases were able to avoid you know, surgeries that were being recommended by the medical industry. And you know, the Lord says in John 8, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. And then he says in that same passage, if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed. And you know, it's a sad thing that's happening here in America. Today we're being told that by so many doctors that, well, you know, this is genetic and it's not your fault. There's really nothing you can do about it. You've now got hypertension because your father and your grandfather and so forth had it. And so you're just going to need to take medication the rest of your life. And, you know, sometimes people will call us and they'll say, you know, Joe, can I get this program? I've got hypertension. I say, well, is it controlled? Well, yeah. Well, yeah, you can join, except we want you to know that is a pre-existing condition, and we will not be able to participate in that until you have reversed it. And then they kind of, you can just feel them do a double take at the other end. Well, you know, my doctor says, you know, I'm just stuck with this. It's not my fault. It's hereditary. And I say, well, you know, you can believe your doctor if you want to. You don't have to, though, because thousands of people are reversing hypertension. They're getting off medication. And because they're strengthening their body through proper high-fiber food, vegetables and fruits, and losing weight and strengthening their body through exercise. And really, that's what it is that will change you in so many of these areas and set you free. And so that's what we're after, is to set men free.
And I think, of course, with this sharing program, there's a real incentive to try to get the people just as healthy as possible. Not everybody's going to go along with it, but really it's an idea that time has come. And the fact that, you know, if you were facing a major coronary bypass, you know, and of course, you know, surgery is really wonderful, but then if you don't change your whole lifestyle, it's going to come right on back again. It's only a matter of time. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you will actually send them to a place like the Weimar Institute or similar ones across the country and foot the bill so that they can learn to change their life and change it forever. Now, that to me is one of the most progressive ideas I've ever heard. Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. Somebody asked if you would announce your website and I guess your address, and so we'll do that in just a moment when we get back. We're going to have to get our listeners up in the Great Northwest back with us, and so just a moment while we'll let you give your website and your telephone number. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and if you're out there in the listening audience, you'd like to talk to Joe, the telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But certainly, why don't you give the website and the address? So do you have a website and, of course,
yes,
the telephone number?
Yes, sir. Okay, and I'll give the telephone number first. If you'd like the 800-268-2514, and we only have voicemail at this hour of the day, of course, but 800-268-2514. Now, the website would be biblicalhealthcare.com, biblicalhealthcare.com. And then if you would like to actually access the whole guidelines, you could put a forward slash and put GLJ for Guidelines Joe, and then .pdf.
Okay, so, what am I? Biblicalhealthcare.com, and then what?
And then forward slash GLJ.
GLJ.
Mm-hmm.
All right, fine. Well,
dot PDF. Uh-huh.
All right, fine. All right, well, we've got Nathan calling. So let's go to Nathan and get his thoughts on this. Hi, Nathan. How are you doing?
Oh, hi. Good evening, gentlemen. I have two questions that are strongly health-related. The first one is very biblical. What's your view on consuming blood with meat as far as the biblical prohibition in Genesis 9? Do you think that if we refrain from doing that, that our health problems in society would improve radically?
No, you're talking about eating something like meat or a hamburger or
no. I'm talking about not properly draining the blood, and as the Bible says that we should.
All right, fine. Do you have any thoughts on that, Joe? Or not?
Okay, well, boy, you know, this is one thing I definitely would not say that I'm an expert on, but obviously, I think most Christians know that. You know, because of, you know, what the Old Testament had to say about that, and really what the Lord had to say, that it is good to drain that. And again, I am not very knowledgeable on that. I would say, though, when we touch on the idea of meat, we in our society are probably getting way too much protein. And we know that, people live longer and will do better if they don't have so much protein. Now, you know, the original diet was the Genesis 1:29 diet, where God said to eat, to consume vegetables and fruits and that sort of thing. Later, after the flood, he also included meat, but we also noticed that the life expectancy went down precipitously. Now, the people in the biblical times did eat meat, although it was more for feasting, whereas today in America, we are so wealthy that we can actually afford to feast every day, every meal, and we're getting too much of that. Now, I'm kind of going far afield from your question because I'm really not knowledgeable on the specific question you gave, Nathan, but I
hope...
You
just fine, sir. Yeah,
well, let me put in my two cents worth. Mm-hmm. You know, you remember, Nathan, hearing about Robin Hood. You probably read the story when you were very young, and of course, the way they finally did Robin Hood in is he went in to be bled, and bleeding was a standard method of treatment in ancient England and Old England, and of course, even at the time of George Washington and in the early colonial days, bleeding was something that was used here in the United States. Now, why was that? Well, it was to get rid of iron. And, of course, they had noted, well, they didn't know why, but they'd noted that if you had too much iron in your system, for the average individual, why, of course, they didn't do as well. And, of course, one reason you would want to drain the blood out of an animal so you wouldn't get that iron that's in the blood. What happens, of course, if you have people who take in a lot of iron, why, of course, they really are not healthy at all. This is why many times women, you know, they, of course, lose blood on a monthly basis, and even though they may be a little bit anemic, they live a lot longer than men do. And one suggestion is it's because they don't have so much iron. When you have a high iron content in your system, why, of course, you're much more prone to infection and other degenerative diseases. And our friend Bill Sardi has written a fascinating book on the iron time bomb, and you might go to his website, askbillsardi.com, and there'll be a link to all of the website that has all of his books on it. And I think this is a very, very real issue that we get too much iron in, and iron really can get us into a lot of problems. And maybe the Lord just sort of knew that when he put that admonition in as to the draining of the blood from meat. Does that answer your question?
Oh, I'm sure it does, but I have one more.
Okay, well, you're going to have to hold it until we get back from, because we're going to have to go to a break here. So can you hang on?
Yes, please.
All right, fine. And if you're out there in the listening audience and you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the central coast of California, 468295. That's 464-8295. And, of course, you want to go to Bill Sadi's website. It's AskBillSadi.com. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and guest this evening is Joe Foreman. And Joe, of course, you were going to give your website, but you were going to give your address and your telephone number. You hang on there, and Nathan will be right with you in a minute. But I think we got interrupted as Joe was giving the website. And did we get the telephone number out?
I believe we did.
Well, just give it out again.
Okay. Our phone number here would be 800-268-2514. 800-268-2514.
Of course, and you said, of course, we won't have anybody there this evening to answer the telephone, so you got that out.
But we do have the voicemail on.
All right, so you have that, and do you want to give out your address? You think the website, and just people call you on the telephone, and then you'll get the information to them?
Yes, that would be great. And the website, again, is biblicalhealthcare.com. And if they would like to get the guidelines and read that, they can go / on the end of Biblical Healthcare and / GLJ for Guidelines Joe and then .pdf.
All right, fine. So and now, Nathan, if you got another question, go ahead.
Well, it's a slight switch in gears, but it has to do with calcium. this is not really so much biblical as it is actually personal experience. I was taking Prevacid for a while for my stomach problems, and it worked very well. The problem is there seemed to be a side effect that I believe came from the Prevacid having to do with muscular convulsions and the like.
Mm-hmm.
And I stopped using it, but, you know, the convulsions seemed to continue, and they seemed to continue for months and months, and my doctors, you know, they weren't really that helpful.
Now,
well,
sort of convulsions were these? Were these like a grand mal convulsion?
No. They were neuromuscular.
All right,
it was
fine.
I don't want to overdo it. And it was fading. I don't want to say it was lasting, but it seemed to be cyclical, and it seemed to come back slightly. Well, I walked into the health food store, and, you know, I talked to a lady there, and she looked it up, and she prescribed two things. One was a vitamin B-C supplement, and the other was calcium and magnesium. And, you know, it's just the strangest thing, but that it really does seem to work. And I'm sure that my doctors could have bothered to look that up. But what is it with doctors and diet? And why is it that doctors learn everything in medical school, but they don't seem to focus so much on diet? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, fine. Thanks, and it's a very legitimate question. Do you want to touch that, Joe, or do you want
me
to take that?
Yes, you know, I personally believe that the hundreds of thousands of medical doctors we have in America are extremely intelligent people. They couldn't have got through medical school. But the problem is the paradigm that controls modern medicine does not include hardly anything in the area of nutrition. And I'm thinking here of a book entitled Food is Your Best Medicine. It's written by a medical doctor, Henry Beeler. And he talks about how he went to medical school, and the study of nutrition was very sketchy. Even today, he goes on, most doctors are painfully ignorant of the real advances in nutritional science. And in his case, he got away from drugs and went to nutrition totally. Here's another quote from Julian Whitaker, MD. He says, many people are already aware that doctors are woefully ignorant in nutrition. This is a shocking statistic considering that 6 of 10 of the leading causes of death are directly related to diet. Now, I want to make clear that, you know, there are some very fine doctors out there who have discovered and gotten deeply into nutrition, and they are becoming extremely successful with helping people regain health by feeding the cells of the body. So I don't want to make blanket generalizations here, but the truth of the matter is most of the medical industry are using drugs to make this symptom go away, and then that drug causes another problem. Then they have to use another drug, and, you know, it's just amazing to me that there are people out there that are on 4 or 5 different prescription drugs, because this one leads to a problem there. Now they need a new drug to counteract that one. And sometimes it's 10 or 12 or 14. I mean, it's just amazing. But, we believe, and we believe most, and obviously most of the modern nutritionists believe that most of these problems will go away if we feed the proper fuel to the body. And that's what we're after here in the Christian Care Ministry, is to help people be set free and be healthier. And, of course, one of the nice benefits is that we end up with a much lower price to take care of ourselves medically.
Well, you know, I agree with everything you're saying. And being a physician myself and trained in traditional medicine, we never, of course, talked about a lot of these things, specifically of nutrition. In fact, we were always sort of told to scoff at the people who wanted to take vitamins. Now, 50 years later, why the AMA has come out and said, hey, everybody ought to take a multivitamin every day. Well, you mean they were wrong all this time? Yeah, they were absolutely wrong. As far as Nathan's remark was, you know, he's amazed. He goes into the health food store. Somebody looks this thing up and says, oh, you want to take magnesium and calcium. Now, why? Well, we know, for instance, that both of these have to do with relaxation of the muscles. And certainly, for instance, magnesium is excellent as far as the heart is concerned, and will tend to cut down on arrhythmias. But this is not something you're ordinarily is used. Mike, they have all these expensive drugs, and let me tell you why. It is simply because the drug companies control our medical meetings. They can finance the journals. Yes. And you start putting things in there that are going to cut down on the income of the drug companies, and they're not going to advertise in your magazine, and you can't afford to put it out, so you've got to keep your advertisers. And that's the reality of what's going on. Now, I have the advantage. I'm not answerable to anybody. The only people who can get me off the air, if they can, of course, if the station doesn't want me on, why, I'm not going to be on. They can put me off the air. But as long as I pay for our time, which I do on the stations all across the country, and, of course, where do I get the money? I get money from people out there who believe in what we're doing, and they believe in us, they support us. And so I'm answerable not to drug companies or to corporations. I'm answerable to our listeners. And so far, they've been very, very loyal, even with the downturn in the economy, and thank goodness for that, because we are able to continue doing what we're doing. But I believe that certainly that the idea of using calcium and magnesium, and you want to have it in the proper ratio, is an excellent idea for people who are having some cardiac irregularity, some muscle problems. But you got to know where to look it up. There are excellent books out there, but you're not going to find them in the average doctor's office, because they deal with nutrition and they deal with herbs and all of these things that have been used for so long. But what most people don't understand is almost every proprietary medicine, or so many of them, are actually, of course, coming from herbs or from other medicines that have been used for many, many years, and they simply find the active ingredient of something that you might be able to buy at a health food store, and they package it and put on a tremendous drive to get people to use it, and first raise the price up to where nobody can afford it. Right now, let's go to Steve, who's calling from Southern California. And again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Our guest is Joe Foreman. He's from MediShare. The telephone number there is 800-268-2514. That's 800-268-2514. And we've checked this out. We don't hesitate at all to recommend it to you. Steve, are you there?
Yes, I am.
It's good to hear from you. Haven't heard from you in some time. How's everything going for you?
Well, everything is going fine. I am taking herbal, natural medicine type of stuff and trying to eat in moderation and exercise regularly.
Good for you.
But sometimes I end up having these hunger pangs and not really doing anything about it.
Well, if you're having hunger pangs, I mean, there are lots of fruits and vegetables that you can eat that are really very, very filling.
But anyway, what I called about were two things. I remember a few years ago, I was trying to prove to people, to a few people that you don't have to define overweight by the way the charts and books do, but you can be biblically correct and define it as not having the health and energy to go about and do the things that God has called you to do. And one of the things that I started doing was when I was exercising, standing on the promises in Proverbs of rewards to the diligent.
Mm-hmm.
Putting out all the sweat equity and saying, hey, it'll be worth all the sweat equity I pump out. To
okay. Okay, anything else?
Well, it's about accountability to man. I have heard, and I know that it's been confirmed in my own life, that in matters of the flesh, where such as smoking or overeating, if your first thought is, well, what do I say to so-and-so when I meet with him on Monday at the first, you know, twinge of temptation, if that first, then the way you're handling it is very is very disobedient to God, because he is not going to share his glory with another.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And accountability to man is a snare to be avoided at all costs. 56 men believe that. That's why they signed the Declaration of Independence.
Okay. Well said. Thank you so much, Steve. Bye-bye, and God bless
you.
Bye.
You too.
And, of course, recalling that tomorrow is the birthday of the United States. And I would hope that you would all get a copy of the Declaration of Independence and read it, especially the second paragraph that lays out the foundation of America and why we are different than any other nation. And, of course, those thrilling words, "For we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And to secure these rights, governments are created among men to..." And, of course, this is what it's all about. The reason for you have government is to secure our God-given rights, not to provide for our medical care, not to provide for anything else other than to secure our God-given rights. Now, you need a local police force. Certainly, you need local help for people, and, of course, primary help ought to be coming out of the church and out of the family. But there's a place locally providing for the people who are really in need. And long before we had the welfare state, we had in every community in this entire nation a local free hospital. We had usually a poor farm where people could go and they'd have a place to sleep and they'd have food to eat until they could get back on their feet. And we called it charity. But, of course, when you get away from charity and you get to welfare, and then the next thing you do is you get entitlements, and then pretty soon everybody who is entitled to all these benefits are dependent upon the government for them. And then when they don't get them, they're out in the streets rioting as they are in Europe today as they're beginning to talk about having to cut back on all these entitlements because there isn't any money to pay them. And there aren't enough young people being born to actually fund the older folks and the people who've been promised that the government's going to take care of them, and they are going to take care of them. And one of the most efficient means would be to simply get rid of the elderly, and believe me, that is not too far away. Well, we're getting far afield in our discussion this evening. We have with us Joe Foreman. We're talking about MediShare, which is a wonderful, wonderful Christian approach to skyrocketing healthcare costs. And so I know, and certainly some of the scripts that you sent me, you talked about letting people know when a Christian brother is having medical problems, really serious medical problems. How does that work?
You mean like one of our members?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you know, we have a wellness department that is very active and very supportive. So whenever any of our members do get into trouble, they begin to have a problem, and they, perhaps go to a doctor, and he says, "Wow, you got a problem, and this is what we think we need to do." Our members know that they need to call our wellness department so that they can interview them and find out what's going on and give them counsel and advice, and perhaps have one of our medical doctors on staff talk with them. And so, in many, many cases, we've been able to avoid unnecessary surgeries, help people chart a new course that really helps them overcome the problem just basically through an improved lifestyle, you know, nutrition, exercise, and so forth.
All right, and so this is really sort of a unique and novel idea. Is there anybody, any other medical sharing program or any healthcare program you know that really does this?
You know, there, Dr. Stan, there have been a number of Christian programs that have come together. Unfortunately, most of them have had just varying degrees of success because they were somewhat simplistic. They believed that if they just simply brought Christians together who don't use tobacco and don't abuse alcohol and obviously don't use illegal drugs, that everything would be just hunky-dory. But, you know, the problem that we're finding is that, and this is really a sad statistic, it's really a disgrace, but Christians in general out there in the public are no different when it comes to the incidence of heart attacks and heart disease and cancer than the non-Christians. Now, in our program, of course, we lift up a standard, and people have to, you know, they have to measure up in order to get in the first place. And then we do lift up that standard and ask them to change their lifestyle and to live in a more godly and more disciplined manner. And of course, the results are that our utilization is way below that of the rest of the society out there.
Well, now you insist, though, that people are Christians before they can come into this. You're
yes.
not going to take somebody in who says, "Well, I'm a Christian, but I don't go to church."
Yes, no secret disciples here. we do need to be in fellowship. The Bible is quite clear that it says, "Let us in Hebrews, 10:24." Or 25, let us not forsake the assembling of ourselves together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another all the more as we see the day drawing near. So we do need to not forsake assembling together. We need to get together and encourage fellow Christians. And so we do, for that reason, require regular attendance at a Bible-believing church.
All right, fine. Well, now, what would you do then with a Catholic who has certainly believed in the divinity of Jesus Christ, but they go, of course, not to a Bible, what you and I probably would refer to as a Bible-believing church, but they go to a Catholic church, and they certainly are. How do you take care of something like that?
Okay, that's always a difficult one. You know, the truth of the matter is, Dr. Stan, that, you know, not everybody that's got all the Baptist lingo about being saved and being born again, how do we know for positive? Only the Lord knows.
Absolutely.
Now, you know, there's some Roman Catholics out there that, you know, they do believe in Jesus Christ, obviously, and they have devoted their life to Christ. So when I get a Roman Catholic that calls... you know, and I always am really, you know, impressed with the fact that it's not my place to judge, but if, when I ask them, well, have you devoted your life to Christ? And if they come through very clear on that, then I believe it's my place to believe that. They may not use our lingo, you know, and of course the born again lingo, that's not ours. That's what Jesus said to Nicodemus, you must be born again. And so I usually try to point that out. But there are Catholics out there who've gotten into the scriptures and they are comfortable with the concept of being born again, even though their priest may not be using that from the pulpit.
And so, you know, you would not exclude anybody, because you'd exclude somebody who said they were born again if you thought that they really weren't, that they were just sort of saying the right thing.
Well, there have been a couple of those, and some cases where, you know, a man left his wife and was living in immorality with another woman, and when we found out... you know, we verified it through the pastor, and we just said, no, you need to straighten your life out before you join our group. And not that we're perfect, but that's pretty blatant.
Sure.
So we just urge that person to get right with the Lord, and God can forgive, but in that state, he wouldn't be good for our program. And so we do kind of lift up that standard.
Well, you know, because this is sort of a strange thing, because most of the insurance companies want to get as many people as they can into the program.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know that our program is only as good as the people in it. So we do, you know, have that standard. And we're quite willing to tell people, well, no, but we're not here to sit as their judge either, but we encourage people to get right with the Lord. One gentleman called and he wanted to get the information and join, and so when I question him, well, where, do you affiliate with a church or a certain denomination? He says, well, I don't go to church because there's too many hypocrites there, and I just listen to Christian radio. And so I just came back and said, well, you know, that really won't do because it's not scriptural. And you need to deal with, what the Bible says about not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together. He was not very happy with me, but we lift the standard, and that's where it's going to be.
Well, I think you have to make a standard, and unfortunately, it's your program, and you can say whatever you want to. You're not, covered. You have to take everybody into this program, because it's not like an insurance program. And you're not discriminating on the basis of race or anything. You're, of course, discriminating on with your decision that people who are not going to church. And I've got lots of problems with the churches today. But we ought to be able to find one someplace that would have some things that we would agree with. And I go to a church, and I don't agree with everything that our minister says, but he loves the Lord. Mm-hmm. I've learned so much from that church, more than any church I've ever attended before in my 74 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're there every Sunday, and really, I think we all need to be going to church and of course, assembling as we're told to in the Scriptures.
And furthermore, you know, we're there to serve, not just be entertained. And unfortunately, a lot of Christians now, they're going to go to be entertained, and they want everything to be just right to please them. And, if a church is biblically, teaching the truth and believing it, they could have a whole lot of faults, but you know, we're there to minister and let God use us in their lives too. So
what was that old line? I've forgotten what it was. If I could ever find a church and join it, why it wouldn't be perfect anymore.
There you go.
I think this is real one of the things that we have to recognize. We're never going to find a perfect church, but certainly we try to find the very best one that we can, the one we feel the most comfortable in. And of course, we go certainly to honor the Lord, and of course, to be to learn from somebody who's dedicated their life to the Scriptures. Well, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. If you have a question, a comment, if you think this is a good idea, or you think it is a bad idea, you think that there may be better ways to do it. But, you know, I am so intrigued with this. Now, of course, I'm at my age, I've got my Medicare, and so I really don't need to change. However, one of these days, Medicare is going to go belly up. They're not telling you that. In fact, I don't know how far our listeners are noticing, but the current administration is saying, oh, we've got this terrible crisis and the expense of drugs. You know, some people are spending so much money on drugs, why they just don't have any money for food. So we're from the government, and we're here to help. Now, they never mentioned that it's the government and their various programs that have created the crisis in healthcare delivery, and of course, they're working hand in glove with these various drug companies. In fact, now the former president, CEO of Cyril, Cyril Company, one of the biggest drug companies in America, just happens to be our Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld. And we find, of course, the administration permeated with people with ties to the drug company. But the thing is, they say, well, because there's a problem out there, now we have a solution. Why we want to see make sure our senior citizens have excellent health care, and so we're going to shift them over to these PPOs, and of course we want to get the market working. And what they're really talking about, and they don't want to tell you, is they want to ration your access to health care. That's what it's really all about. That's why they want to get you out of the Medicare system, because they can't ration after all, they started rationing it. Old people would be out there in the wheelchairs and with the canes rioting in the streets, because they've been promised that they're going to be taken care of. So now they've got these subtle ways, oh, we're going to put you over here. You know, there's nothing to worry about. Medicare is just as solvent as our federal government. Of course, the problem is our government's not very solvent, and neither is Medicare. And, of course, as Pete Peterson said recently on national television, and he's one of the guys who really runs the country, the former director of the Council on Foreign Relations, talking about the Social Security Trust Fund, there is no trust. And there is no fund. And one of our listeners was good enough to get me a copy of that. And so I could watch it and actually hear him saying that there is no trust. There is no fund. and we're just going to have to put off the age of retirement a couple of years to begin with, and then keep raising the age of retirement till we can get this thing back financially stable. And of course, Medicare is even really in worse shape down the line, and that's what all this talk about. Oh, we want to pay for your drugs. Where are you going to get the money to pay for the drugs? You know, you're talking about, well, it's not going to cost. We've worked this out actuarially, and that's what they said about Medicare. They said when Medicare came in, why, by the year 2000, it's going to cost only $9 billion. And, of course, they weren't that far off. I think it was $90 billion, $93 billion. They were off by a figure of about 10 and the cost of that. And of course, never believe what the actuarial figures are from the government. Now, because, of course, the fellows who put them together have retired with a fat pension. And, of course, we are left with the problems that they've created. Well, Joe, we're just about out of time, mm-hmm. and what are your thoughts for our listeners? Why should people really consider joining Medicare, MediShare? Of course, maybe when Medicare goes belly up, I'll want to join. Do you have any age limit on it?
No, not really. We're accepting people from, basically, I think they have to be at least 18 to join, but we have applications from people of all ages, people who are on Medicare, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, whatever, and we can accept those people, if they're willing to, qualify according to our guidelines.
Okay, fine. Well, what's the parting thought you'd like to have for our listeners this evening?
Well, sometimes people say, well, you folks are kind of exclusive and you're trying to be off by yourself. And really, we don't feel like that is the issue. We believe that what the Lord wants us to do is to glorify Him, to show the world a better way, because the way we're heading is really not good. You know, the Bible says the prudent man sees evil and hides himself. And, we're living in a nation where out of 100 industrialized nations in the world, the United States is now ranked, according to the U.S. News and World Report article, 42nd in life expectancy and 82nd out of 100 nations in the effective prevention of disease. The American Medical Association and the World Health Organization have said that the United States is in the worst epidemic of chronic and degenerative diseases that mankind has ever known. And Dr. Stan, you were talking about drugs. Whenever I hear about drugs, what that means to me is people who are not willing to change their life, or they're simply not knowledgeable. They're not aware. They're ignorant of the truth of nutrition, and so they're using drugs to engineer symptoms instead of changing their life. And this, obviously, anybody can see that this is not going to work out long term. In 1960, it took 5% of the gross national product to pay America's medical bills. Today, we're looking at 17%. Just around the corner, it's going to be 20%. And they're saying 25% of the gross domestic product is going to be required to pay the medical bill for America by the year 2020. And so more and more people are too busy and too entertained and too busy being entertained to learn about how to take care of their body. And so they're just running to the doctor to get drugs. We believe that we have an opportunity as Christians to show that since we belong to the Lord, we should be showing the world a better way and a more efficacious way of living life and living in freedom. And the truth shall set you free.
God bless you. Thank you so much. Our guest has been Joe Foreman. The telephone number is 800-268-2514. That's 800-268-2514. Nobody there this evening, but there'll be somebody there the first of the week. And there is an answering machine tonight?
Yes, we have voicemail on tonight.
All right, fine. God bless you. Thanks so much for being with us, Joe. It's been a fascinating hour. I've certainly enjoyed it.
Thanks so very much.
Bye-bye. Mm-hmm. Okay, fine. We'll be back here in just a moment. This is the time we have to bid adieu to our listeners in the Great Northwest. Oh, hope you have a wonderful 4th of July. We will be here again tomorrow evening. I want to be able to share some ideas with you then. And so, until then, remember, we hope many of you want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters on number 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And may the Lord be with you. Well, good evening, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls because we have with us on the line right now Bill Federer, and Bill is one of my favorite guests. He's written a number of books. One of my favorite books, which I keep right beside me here, is America's God and Country. And, of course, we have not only the book, we have it on CD with about twice as much information, but that book has close to 800 pages. How many pages is that, Bill?
845 pages,
has all these wonderful quotations from the founding fathers of America and even more contemporary people, but mostly the people who created America and what they had to say about God and what they had to say about Jesus Christ. And really, it's a wonderful source of information. And then, of course, the CD even has more information. It's all there. We just have to know it. We have it to have it readily available. And that's why I keep this right next to where I do my programs. And then, of course, he's written a book on the Ten Commandments. He's written a book on St. Patrick and on Santa Claus and on George Washington Carver. All great, great, great books that, of course, you will want to have and enjoy. He's got some other CDs out there that with all sorts of information on them. But this evening we're going to be talking about his new book. What's it called? The American Minute?
Yes, American Minute.
Well, why don't you sort of tell us about that?
Well, a few years ago I put together a radio spot that's aired on probably 100 or so stations around the country. It's a little one-minute historical vignette of what happened on each date in American history. And, something that's profound, something that's worth remembering, and then that somehow I find a way to bring it back to the faith or the values that the founders had. And I email it out to about 6,000 people a day, so people, across the country can sign up for it and get it. Also, websites like WorldNet Daily and townhall.com and statesman.org, D. James Kennedy's site, have it right there on their website so that people can click and read the American Minute right there.
And of course, is there a different one every day?
Yes, a different one for each day.
Yeah, I'm going to have to talk to my webmaster and see if we can put it up there, because I really would love to carry something like that. And you even put that in a little book, didn't you, with a spiral binding on it?
Well, actually, I printed it as a paperback book.
Right.
So it's has one page a day, plus all the end notes. And, for example, today's American Minute for July 4th, and, well, we're almost there to July 4th, but it starts off, the Declaration of Independence was approved this day, July 4th, 1776. John Hancock was the first to sign. He said, "The price on my head has just doubled." Ben Franklin signed next, saying, "We must hang together, or most assuredly, we shall hang separately." Of the 56 signers, 17 lost their fortunes, 12 had their homes destroyed, 9 fought and died, 5 were arrested as traitors, 2 lost sons in the war. As Samuel Adams signed, he said, "We have this day restored the sovereign to whom all men ought to be obedient. He reigns in heaven, and from the rising to the setting of the sun, let his kingdom come." And that was the July 4th American Minute. It's interesting, July 5th, I refer to a little-known fact, but it was big when it happened. Two of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, died on July 4th, exactly 50 years to the day of when they signed the Declaration of Independence.
You know, the fact that that would have happened just by accident is almost beyond comprehension. I mean, here were the two key people who played the key roles in the drawing up of the Declaration of Independence. I mean, these were the two men, of course, they eventually had many, many differences between them, and eventually they became fast friends. But these were the two men who really, probably more than anyone else, are responsible for that document, which is certainly the statement of principles of this great country. And the fact they would die 50 years later on the same day, I just can't believe that happened by accident.
Well, that's exactly what John Quincy Adams said, and he was the president of the United States when this happened. He said, "A coincidence so wonderful gives confidence that the patriotic efforts of these men was heaven-directed, and furnishes a new hope that the prosperity of these states is under the special protection of a kind providence." And then he went on to say, "Since our last meeting in this place, the 50th anniversary of the day when our independence was declared, two of the principal actors in that solemn scene, the hand that penned the ever-memorable declaration, and the voice that sustained it in debate, were by one summons, at a distance of 700 miles from each other, called before the judge of all to account for their deed done upon earth." And I thought, you know, that's the idea they had back then, was that, you know, everything we did in our lives, we were someday going to have to stand before God and be held accountable. And so tremendous coincidence there that, I mean, it's almost like the Liberty Bell. You know, it was rung at the reading of the Declaration of Independence, July 9th, 1776. But the Liberty Bell cracked at the funeral for John Marshall, who was the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. And so a lot of people felt like that was, you know, a sign that here, you know, something's happened in our country with him dying and that bell cracking.
Well, Christian, I believe, having studied the founding of this country, that, you know, God's hand was really on this. I mean, the stories about Washington, his victories against just insurmountable odds. And you can just see God's hand over and over and over again in the foundation of this country. How tragic it is today, as our Supreme Court repudiates God. Now they're removing the Ten Commandments from various schoolhouses and courthouses and things of that sort. Because we have people at the highest echelons of this government who hate God and are going to do everything they can to destroy the Judeo-Christian foundation of this once great nation. And of course, there is no incidence in all history where a nation has turned against God, where God has not eventually abandoned that nation. And it's because people don't know about the Christian heritage of this nation or the beliefs of our founding fathers or even why America was founded as it is. That's the reason we're in so much trouble today. They certainly never teach this in school. They never talk about it on television. And certainly even most of our ministers won't talk about it.
Well, you know, you mentioned the different court cases with them removing God from the pledge and Ten Commandments down. And I was listening to Barry Lynn and Dershowitz, the ACLU.
Alan Dershowitz, yes, one of my favorite people.
and they were, you know, always saying that, well, they want just the government to be neutral when it comes to religion, that they want the schools neutral when it comes to religion. So I look up the word religion, and I may have mentioned this on your program before, Stan, but if you, in the Random House Unabridged Dictionary of the English Language, it defines religion as a set of beliefs. Webster's New World Dictionary defines religion as a system of belief. And then the word belief is defined as opinions, convictions, thoughts upon which one bases their actions. So as long as you're doing actions, you have thoughts that precede those actions, and that collection of thoughts is your belief system, your religion. As long as the government is doing actions, the government has thoughts that precede those actions, and that collection of thoughts is the government's belief system or religion. So in a sense, you can never have a separation of religion and government. You just swap out which belief system is going to underlie the actions of the government. And our founders had a deity-based belief system. That's why every president swore into office with their hand upon a Bible and ended their oath with, "So help me God," that every one of the 50 state constitutions acknowledge God, and so forth. When the ACLU says, well, they just want to be neutral, really, they're not being honest, because they're trying to promote a state religion. They're trying to set up a belief system, a non-deity-based belief system. what one of the Supreme Court cases referred to as no belief religion. Religion is secular humanism. And I have a couple court cases just to highlight how our country is just, you know, the decisions today to remove the Ten Commandments and to remove under God are so different than just a few years ago. This is a case in 1952. It's called Zorich versus Clausen. And the Supreme Court said, we agree, of course, that the state may not establish a, quote, religion of secularism in the sense of affirmatively opposing or showing hostility to religion, thus preferring those who believe in no religion over those who do believe. So it says a religion of secularism, that the government's not supposed. And then here is the case of Abington Township versus Shemp, Supreme Court, 1963. It says, secularism is unconstitutional, preferring those who do not believe over those who do believe. It is the duty of government to deter no-belief religions. And faculties of government cannot offend religious principles. The state may not establish a religion of secularism in the sense of affirmatively opposing or showing hostility to religion, thus preferring those who believe in no religion over those that do believe.
But that's exactly what they are doing today. In our schools, why, of course, they teach evolution but not creation? Well, why not teach both of them? Because, of course, if they can teach only evolution and not allow the children to hear the other side of the debate, they can destroy their faith in the Bible and in the teachings of their church and the teachings of their parents. That's what it's really all about. This whole thing is an agenda to, of course, create a secular society with children who have no value of right and wrong, who believe in no absolutes, and, of course, creating moral chaos. Because they understand, which the average American today doesn't understand, that those who will not be ruled by God will be ruled by tyrants. And that's exactly where we are headed today, to the all-powerful state. Instead, of course, this concept of limiting the power of government and letting the people be free, they want unbridled government and, of course, a boot stamping on the human face forever. That's exactly where we're headed. And where is the outcry from the church? It's silent. It's deafening in its silence.
Well, you know, my wife was commenting on that exact same thing, and I said, you know, one of the articles I read said that back in Kennedy's administration, they noticed how the religious people tended to vote conservative and Republican. And so the idea was they wanted to destabilize and, in a kind word for destroy, the religious base of our country. Because if the religious people voted Republican and they got rid of the religious base, then they were going to have less Republican votes, and the liberals and the Democrats could gain power. But that's what we've seen, is that there's an attack on the Judeo-Christian faith, and it's true that, you know, people that go to church are more inclined to be against abortion, more inclined to be against redefining the marriage, and more for traditional values. Here's one more quote. This is from the United States District Court, 1983, Western District of Virginia, in the case of Crockett versus Sorensen. It says, the First Amendment was never intended to insulate our public institutions from any mention of God, the Bible, or religion. When such insulations occur, another religion, such as secular humanism, is effectively established. Clearly, the Establishment Clause can be violated in this regard without showing an outright hostility to the traditional theistic religions. And, you know, one of the quotes I found recently that highlights this was when Ron Brown was a coach in Nebraska, and he was being considered for a job at Stanford University. But he was rejected because Stanford wanted to be a diverse, tolerant campus and, you know, pro-homosexual, and this coach was a Christian. And so they were saying that they were going to be intolerant to him because they wanted to maintain a tolerant atmosphere, and which shows the hypocrisy there. But they gave a quote, and this is from the Daily Nebraskan, April 13th, 2002. Pat Terrault, co-chairwoman of the Committee of Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, and Transgendered Concerns at the University of Nebraska, stated, we shouldn't be discriminating on religion either, but you get into a slippery slope on whose belief system you value more. That line, whose belief system you value more. What she just did was show their hand, show her hand. In other words, the ACLU has been saying, well, we just want it to be religion neutral. And when what I've been saying tonight is, no, they're not trying to be religion neutral. They're pushing their religion, their belief system. And this is what this girl said here, is it's not a question of religion. It's a question of whose belief system you value more.
And you know the answer to that, because I remember hearing Dan Rather say that one time. Of course, he's reading the script that's put out for him. But, you know, of course, all these people, they want, of course, to get these Christian ideas. And, they want values in the schools, but whose values are going to be? Well, I don't want my values there, and I don't want Bill Federer's values. I want God's values, because it was upon God's law that America was founded. Certainly, anybody who's ever read anything in history of this country will realize that our laws were based upon Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England for almost 100 years, or well over 100 years. That was the basis of American law. And if you read Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England, they were based upon the Bible. And that's why this latest atrocity from the Supreme Court, where they have legalized homosexuality. Now, first of all, I don't think the federal government should have anything to do with homosexuality. If they were obeying the Constitution, they would realize that matters having to do with life, liberty, morality have all to be taken care of at the state and the local level. Nothing. And that comes from the 45th of the Federalist Papers. But none of this was to be handled by the federal government or by our Supreme Court. These were to be factors handled by each of the individual states, and some states might vote in favor of homosexuality, some might vote against it. But once all power has been taken to Washington, D.C., by the Supreme Court, then, as Jefferson said, we will have a society as venal and oppressive as the one we've recently been separated from. And that was what Thomas Jefferson actually feared, was, of course, the Supreme Court doing exactly what it's doing today. But Congress doesn't have to allow it, but they're going along with it. And the president doesn't have to allow it, but he's going along with it. And, of course, the church doesn't have to go along with it, but they're saying, oh, well, it's the law of the land. If we object, why, after all, Romans 13 tells us that we object to what the government is doing, why, of course, we are in revolt against God. And that's one of the biggest problems in America today, is the church seems to be on the wrong side.
Well, yeah, the founders had this concept where you submit to the king as long as the king is submitted to God.
Right.
You know, you submit to the laws of the land as long as the laws of the land are submitted to God. And but here is a Supreme Court case in 1885, and I bring this out to show how the court has changed with this decision just last week, saying that, you know, homosexual lifestyles and so forth are fine. This is the case of Murphy versus Ramsey in 1885. It says, and again, this is addressing the polygamy situation in Utah and the western states where they said that, you know, a guy could have more than one wife. It says, every person who has a husband or a wife living and marries another is guilty of polygamy and shall be punished. Certainly no legislation can be supposed more wholesome and necessary in the founding of a free and self-governing commonwealth than that which seeks to establish it on the basis of the family, as consisting in and springing from the union for life of one man and one woman in the holy state of matrimony. It defines it as one man and one woman. Now, back then, the number was the question, because they had one man and lots of women in polygamy situations. But today, the question is the sex, you know, instead of one man and one another man. But back then, the original Republican Party platform of 1856, and you can find it on the Internet, and it says that the Republican Party was formed to eliminate those two relics of barbarism, polygamy and slavery. So the purpose of the Republican Party was to get rid of polygamy and slavery. In other words, they took a stand for the traditional definition of a marriage being one man and one woman. And I bring that out to show that what's happening right now is a complete departure from what our founders and early leaders had. It's just a political agenda. And one of the other things, before we get totally away from it, is, you know, again, those court cases where they were taking God out of our pledge and so forth, I came up with three reasons why it's important for America to stay under God. And I can share those quickly if you'd like.
You go right ahead. We really don't have any a planned program. We're just sort of chatting here, and we got maybe a few thousand people listening in on our conversation. And incidentally, if you're out there and you do have a question or comment, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But go ahead, Bill.
Well, here again is the Supreme Court in 1952. It says, our institutions presuppose a supreme being. Our institutions presuppose a supreme being. It's like, well, what institutions and why is it important for them to assume there's a supreme being? Well, one of the institutions is rights. You know, our founders had a belief system. It was a deity-based belief system. It's the idea that the rights come from a deity. They come from a higher power. The Declaration of Independence says, all men are created equal and are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. And to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. So they understood that rights came from God. The government's job is to protect your rights. John F. Kennedy pointed this out in his inaugural address, 1961. The rights of man come not from the generosity of the state, but from the hand of God. Well, if there is no God, then where do the rights come from? They come from the generosity of the state. And the state becomes the new God. It's the new supreme authority. And no longer is the state's purpose to protect your rights. The state is now the author of the rights. It's the one that dispenses the rights to you. And then it's switched from, instead of the state existing for your benefit, now you exist for the state's benefit. And that's where the communist countries started. Communism came from Karl Marx. Karl Marx got it from Hegel. Hegel was this German philosopher in the 1820s. He had this idea of utilitarianism, where a person's worth is dependent on their utility, their ability to contribute to the whole. And we see that in a television series that's on, very popular, where a person's worth is dependent on their utility, their ability to contribute. And the name of that show is The Survivor Program. If you can contribute, you stay. If you're not, you're voted off. And that was Hegel's philosophy. Your worth is dependent on your utility. Hegel also had the philosophy of rationalism. He said nothing is real unless it's provable. And he said he couldn't prove God, so God's not real, and therefore there's no eternal life. And he said the closest you can come to eternal life is to create a government that will exist after you're dead. And he influenced Marx, who started communism. So that's where communism is that it's a creation of a government, and your job is to help perpetuate this government. Whereas our founding fathers said, no, you've got the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And the government's job is to help you keep those rights. And if you have a dream or a desire that's a godly one, that you want to be happy and bless yourself and others, then the government's supposed to help protect those rights. Where the communist countries say, no, your purpose is to exist to perpetuate this government. And again, it's a complete switch from the founders saying the government exists for your benefit to now you exist for the government's benefit.
Well, you know, if you read that first paragraph of this, two lines of the second paragraph of the Declaration, and it says the certain inalienable rights among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. And to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. Governments are instituted to secure our life, our liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And, of course, those are the rights that are given to us not by government, not by Alan Dershowitz or Barry Lynn. They were given to us by God. And the reason, of course, that these people want to do away with this belief in God is so that we won't have those rights. These people are not neutral. These people have the fascist mentality. They're not interested in anything at all other than destroying the Judeo-Christian foundation of this country. And I don't know if we ever saw that wonderful debate between Alan Keyes and Alan Dershowitz.
Yes, I saw it.
And of course, at the end of it, you know, here's Alan Keyes surrounded by the students, and Alan Dershowitz is standing over on the other side of the stage. He's got a couple of professors there. There's not one student over there to congratulating him for his fine debate, because he had totally lost the debate when he admitted he didn't believe in the Declaration of Independence. He didn't believe in the Constitution of the United States. He didn't know what he believed in, but he knew, of course, that Alan Keyes was wrong.
Yeah.
He said, "I don't know what's right, but I do know what's wrong." Well, if you don't know what's right, you're in real trouble, Alan. In fact, this is the man who was suggesting to fight terrorism, we ought to resort to torture.
Wow. Well, you know, there's two other reasons why I found that it's important for our country to be under God. And, I feel like they fit in with what you were saying. The first one is rights come from God. The second one is accountability. You know, Daniel Webster was the Speaker of the House for three U.S. presidents. And he was once asked what the greatest thought was that passed through his mind. I'm sorry, he was the Secretary of State. And he was asked what the greatest thought was that passed through his mind, and he answered, "My accountability to God." And, you know, I think, well, boy, that was, they thought about facing God. And then the president ends his oath with what? "So help me God." And it's congressmen and senators end their oath of office with what? "So help me God." The judicial branch, the court of law, to swear, tell the truth, hold truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God. All three branches of government are based on oaths, and the oaths mention God. Why is it important? Why did the founders want this? Well, the idea of an oath is to call a higher power to hold you accountable to perform what you said you're going to do. And they knew that politicians would have the opportunity to do dirty backroom deals and not get caught. They knew that witnesses would be tempted to lie and not get caught. But if that witness or that politician believed in God, that God was looking over their shoulder, the thought would come into their mind, you know, "I could get by with it in this life, but I'll still have to face God in the next life." Well, that would cause them to have a conscience. It would cause them to hesitate before they gave in to the temptation, and hopefully they'd resist. And but if there is no God, then that same politician in that back room with that same opportunity to do something wrong that would benefit himself and never get caught, well, he'd be a fool not to give in to it. And that's what we've seen from Bill Clinton to Enron. It's like, it's only wrong if I get caught. And William Lynn was the first chaplain of the U.S. House of Representatives. He was elected unanimously May 1st, 1789. William Lynn said, "Let my neighbor once persuade himself that there is no God, and he will soon pick my pocket and not only break my leg but my neck." He says, "If there is no God, there is no law, no future account. Government, then, is simply the ordinance of man only, and we cannot be subject for conscience' sake." In other words, if there's no God, then it's just man making up these laws, and one man's as good as another man, and so why is my laws as good as your laws, and why should I obey yours? And you know, it's whoever has the most power and the point of a gun, that's the only one reason you obey him. Ronald Reagan said this. He said, "Without God, there is no virtue because there is no prompting of the conscience." And then, you know, that brings out the point that if we have a conscience, if our country has a moral internal law, if we believe in God, then we can get by with very little external legal law. It's like a scale. The more you have on the inside, the less you have on the outside. And so if we want to be a free country with very few laws, we have got to have an internal law. And why keep any law? Well, if there is a God that you're going to face, that's the motivation. If there is no God, then there is no motivation to keep any law. And then you have chaos, and the government's only response is to pass more laws. And then I have a third reason, but I can share that after the break here.
We're going to a break? Yes, we are. We'll be back in just a moment. Of course, when we get back, we have John calling from North Carolina. And, of course, we'll welcome your calls here at Radio Liberty at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And we'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Bill Federer, and in just a moment or two, I'm going to have him give out his website, his telephone number. We carry many of his books, but in fact, we probably ought to be carrying This American Minute because it would be something I could probably read every day on the radio as we're opening our programs. But let's first of all go to John calling from North Carolina. Hi, John. How are you doing?
Good evening, sir. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. Do you listen to one of our? Do we have a radio program in your area?
No, sir. I on occasion listen on the internet.
Okay, fine. Because we do have at least one or two outlets there in North Carolina, and I just wondered if you listen to one of them. But go ahead.
Yes, sir. I have several comments. First of all, theistic religions are power structures in which adherents place obedience to an illusory god, but inevitably serve the commandments of men by dint of their god-ruse. The way I see it, it's you can't prove or disprove there is a god. And I wanted to also say that a god that is sovereign and has all power with no accountability, that kind of scares me. So
Okay, now, did you go to college?
Yes, sir.
All right, fine. You know, it takes an awful lot of training and reading philosophers and, reading Kant and Hegel to do away with the natural belief in God, which is really in everybody's hearts. But, you know, I can pretty well tell you went to college because I do, too, and they knocked out my belief in God. But, you know, God can be proven. In fact, there are people who have done this, and we don't have the time to go into extensive application, discussion of it. But you can look at this world that is around us today, and you can look at the perfect order in arithmetic, in astronomy, in music, in biology, in chemistry. I mean, the way everything is organized in chemistry and in physics, and you tell me that just happened by accident, DNA happened just by accident, that there is no creator, you think everything just sort of happened?
No, sir. Definitely. There's definitely an organization, I mean, within chaos. I mean, obviously, but what I'm saying is essentially, I mean, as an organizational concept, because I'm a systems dynamicist, and in an organizational concept, it's one of the worst corruptions, because if you have a being that is only accountable to himself.
No, I'd like to correct you there. God is accountable to his own word. Once he gave his word, he has to keep his word, otherwise he's a liar. And he cannot lie because he's truth. It's against his very nature, and Satan's the father of liars. So God limited himself to his word, and so he's even under authority.
Right. Well, I mean, I don't want to. I mean, I'm not an atheist, and I do see God. I mean, obviously, I've read scriptures, but I mean, I'm not discounting what any of you gentlemen are saying. I mean, obviously, you're intelligent, you know. But I mean, my point of view is that I naturally distrust, you know, authority, and especially, I mean, look at the way we're going with 9/11 and all this.
Well, of course, I would agree with you totally. In fact, we are moving away from this idea of limited government under God to a total government under man. And we have, of course, people who are using, their power unjustly. But do you acknowledge that this America was founded with a basic belief in God?
Yes, sir. I mean, obviously, the Founding Fathers said that government was established among men to protect those inalienable rights, now life, they, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
And those rights, where do they come from?
They come from God.
Okay, fine. So we'll agree on that.
So yeah, so they can't be abdicated by man.
Okay.
Right. I mean, I can go that far with you. That my only thing was, and I guess your guest, he said that that God is limited by his own law or what he's written, and I guess, you know, I guess there could be an argument for that, but anyway, I also wanted to ask you about wedding, the fact of matrimony. That's actually a prerequisite of feudalism, and with arbitrary civil forfeiture with a less burden of proof by the people involved.
I'm sorry. What is your point?
That wedding is a prerequisite of feudalism.
You're talking about a marriage between a man and a woman.
Right. Well, insofar as it is today, I don't have a problem with, as per scripture, I don't really have a problem with that. But today's marriage has nothing to do with Christianity. It has to do with the state, the state controlling the individual through an unconstitutional and illegal pact.
All right. Well, let's get Bill's comment on that. Then we're going to have to move on. Bill, how would you respond to John is saying, that of course marriage has to do with the state and an illegal pact that where of course the state binds men and women together. How would you respond to that?
The family is the basic unit of civilization. There's Adam, there's Eve, and then they got married, they got together, and they had a family. I mean, it's the family is based on a man and a woman in covenant. If you don't have a covenant, then you have men and women sleeping around with each other, and there's total chaos. There's not any family unit. It's the basic building block of society, and there's hundreds of scriptures and hundreds of quotations from great men and thinkers that point to that. And as a matter of fact, if you look at communism, it has its 10 planks of what it wants to accomplish, and one of them is to destroy the family. You read Voltaire's work. Voltaire was the French philosopher in the late 1700s, and he came out against Christianity, and he said that the first thing we need to do is destroy the belief in God and destroy marriage, the sanctity of marriage, and promote adultery and immorality. And it's a cultural battle, but marriage is the basic unit of civilization.
Well, don't you think that John's point, of course, he's looking at what's happening here in our society, and sometimes, of course, you get a divorce and the courts will take the man to the cleaners and really put unfair restrictions on him, track him down wherever he may be in the country with these new federal laws. I think we have to differentiate marriage as a covenant under God. And then, of course, marriage as licensed by the state. And we're really talking about two entirely different issues. We're talking about apples and oranges, and they're not the same. One is God's covenant. One is God's plan. And then, of course, you get the state involved in this, and you got real problems. Would you agree with that?
Yes, yes. I think the state is supposed to support, and again, this is the view that the Founding Fathers has, is that the laws of the state are only valid if they are supported by the laws of God, the higher law.
But, of course, do you think that the laws of the state now are subservient to God's law, or they're simply circumventing God's law for this humanist philosophy?
Nowadays there is a battle going on.
There sure is.
And, here's a quote from Elias Boudinot. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, but he was the president of the Continental Congress, and he was the director of the U.S. Mint under President Washington and Adams. And on July 4th, interesting day here, July 4th, 1793, he said, "Good government generally begins in the family. And if the moral character of a people once degenerate, their political character must soon follow." So it talks about that it starts with the family. And I've got a great article. I say it's great. I mean, I put it together that if you'd like, I can get to you. Here's Noah Webster. He's the author of Webster's Dictionary. In 1839, he said, "In the family are formed the elements of civil government. The family discipline is the model for all social order. The respect for law and the magistrates begins with respect for parents. Families are the nurseries of good and bad citizens. The parent who neglects to restrain and govern his child, or who by his example corrupts him, is the enemy of the community to which he belongs. The parent who instructs his child in good principles and subjects him to correct discipline is the guardian angel of his child and the best benefactor of society. And I could give you lots of quotes
but
like
you
that.
You see, the difference is you're talking about God's plan for the family. Now, the state's plan for the society is don't you dare discipline that child. Child abuse, they'll cry out. We're going to take that child away. We're going to put you in jail. You are abusing that child because you're carrying out the biblical instruction to discipline it. So I think with John's point, and I think he's confusing the two. One is the state, which of course can simply destroy marriage, and the other is God's plan that draws man and woman together and creates the family, which, as you say, is the very foundation of society. Well, let's go to Eric calling from Compton. Is that Compton, California?
Yeah, it's Compton, California. Long time no hear from, Dr.
Okay,
how are you?
Fine. Good to have you with us.
Mr. How do you say his last name?
This is William Federer.
Yeah, I'm holding his book in my hand.
Okay.
Oh, really great.
Do you like it? Now, is that the America's God and Country?
Yes, America's God and Country, Encyclopedia of Quotations.
Isn't that a great book?
Absolutely. You know, I was in a barbershop today, and you know how you talk when you get in barbershops. Well, a conversation came up about Christianity, and we were talking about how America was founded on Christian principles. And to get to the point, one of the guys made a comment that America was founded through rape, thievery, and a lot of things of that nature. And, like, you know, how do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, you ask him, which college did you go to? Which university did you go to? Because, of course, as I said earlier, it takes an awful lot of education before you'll come up with something that stupid. I mean,
it sounds like he's confused with Australia. Australia was formed as a penal colony. England ran out of prison space, and so they shipped their prisoners and convicts to Australia. So their country was unfortunately formed by convicts and murderers and rapists and so forth. America, the history is simple. You had, in Europe, religious persecution. They had this philosophy that whatever the king believed, the kingdom had to believe. And in Germany, the king was Lutheran, and I'm generalizing here. And Switzerland was Calvinist, and Italy, Spain, and France was Catholic, and England was Anglican, and Scotland was Presbyterian, and Greece and Russia was Eastern Orthodox. And if you didn't believe the way the king did, you were persecuted, and you fled. So there were these huge migrations of people leaving one kingdom and going into another. Henry VIII broke from the Pope. Henry VIII wanted another wife. He ended up having six wives. Their fates, unfortunately, were divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived. And
I'd rather be the last one.
And one of Henry's advisors said, well, if you really want to break with Rome, get rid of that Latin Bible and get an English Bible. So Henry got this English Bible, spread it around, and something unexpected happened. People read it, and they began to see how here's this guy divorcing and beheading his wives, that somehow or another he didn't line up with what was in the Bible. And King Henry had made himself the head of the Anglican Church. And so this group of people wanted to purify the Church of England, and they were nicknamed the Puritans. Well, the king didn't think he needed any purifying, thank you, so he persecuted them. And between 1630 and 1640, there was close to 16,000 Puritans fled England and settled in Massachusetts. And there in Massachusetts, they gave religious toleration to who? Only Puritans. Roger Williams was not tolerated. He fled, founded Providence, Rhode Island, and the First Baptist Church in America. Thomas Hooker was not tolerated. He fled, founded Hartford, Connecticut, and the Congregationalist Church. And within a generation, you had tolerance for all Protestant faiths. Another generation went by, they tolerated Catholics. Maryland was the first colony to tolerate Catholics. And in the Declaration, 56 signers, one was Catholic. And then tolerance went out to tolerate liberal Christian denominations, which were considered Unitarians and Universalists. Then it went out to tolerate Jews. Lincoln was the first one to put Hebrew chaplains in the military. Then 1860 was the first time a rabbi was invited to open a session of Congress with prayer. So 1860 is quite a long time after 1620 when the Pilgrims came. And then tolerance went out to tolerate the monotheist, anybody that believed in one God. And their coins say, in God we trust. It's singular. It's one nation under God. It's singular. It's not under gods. We're not talking Buddhism, Hinduism, or Greek mythology. And but then tolerance went out to tolerate anybody that believed in any religion. Finally, it went out to tolerate the atheist, the secular humanist, and the anti-religious. And the last ones in the boat decided it was too crowded and decided to throw the first ones out. So now we have a situation where everybody's tolerated except the belief system that gave birth to the idea of tolerance.
Well, let's just, Eric,
the
people at the barbershop were saying, of course, that America was founded on slavery and what else? Rape
and murder and, yeah.
Okay, fine. Well,
I don't know where he got it. It was just one guy. I don't know where he got it.
Okay, fine. Well, you know, you get some people like that. Ask him for the names of five women that were raped, and that was responsible for founding the country. Well, he can't, of course, come up with that. Well, it was the slave owners raping their slaves. Well, of course, there are always evil people, but what you want to point out is there always been two forces in America. One was the Christian, and then, of course, there was this dark side, this wicked and evil force. Certainly, there were some evil people when America was around, but what was the philosophy of the people who created this country, not some of the people who lived in this country? And then, of course, you go into the background of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. Ask him if he believes in the Declaration of Independence. If he doesn't, say, well, obviously, you hate America. Why don't you move to some other place?
I doubt if he's even familiar with it. But, Doc, I have another question.
Okay.
To what degree do you believe? It's hard to find out exactly how much the slavery problem contributed to the Civil War in history. But I would like to ask Mr. Feeler, how much... It's like, let me make a quick comment. In my opinion, black people had no power in the 1800s, in the 1860s, 1850s, and slavery was one of the issues that brought upon the Civil War as far as everything I can gather.
Yeah, well,
so that had to be, to me, it's obvious. It had to be white, Bible-believing Christians that was pushing the issue.
But the question is, how much
did slavery play a part in the Civil War, do you think?
Well, let's get Bill's view of that, and then I'll tell you my view of it. Go ahead, Bill. What part did slavery play in the Civil War?
Well, I think it was the central part. I think that,
you can't get that anywhere from anybody, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're trying to say, well, it was over economy, and it was over tariffs, and it was over the South wanting to preserve their way of life. Well, their way of life was based on their economy, which was based on the cotton crop, which was based on slavery.
Now, what percentage of the Southerners owned slaves?
I heard a recent tape series by Peter Marshall. He wrote a great book called Sounding Forth the Trumpet. And there were only like...
About 5%.
It was a very small number.
Small percentage.
It was like only 300 of them had more than 100 slaves, and so, you know, but the fact is that, you know, it was, you read the debates of Congress for 20 years before the Civil War, and all of the arguments in Congress was over the slave issue.
But what was really the major issue as far as Lincoln was concerned? And Eric, I'd suggest that you get the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. That's got some very good information in it. Okay. If slavery was the issue, why was it not until 1862 that Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation? And why did he only free the slaves in the South and not in the North?
That's fairly easy to answer, because he did it as a proclamation. The country is set up to have laws passed through congressmen and senators and legislators. Lincoln, he overstepped his bounds by passing a law through his proclamation.
But why didn't he do it at the very beginning of the war? Why did he wait until 1862 if that's what it was really all about?
Well, see, the president's the commander-in-chief, and as commander-in-chief, when he declared the South a war zone, and since the South was a war zone and he was the commander-in-chief, his command, his proclamation, had the force of law. Well, the northern states were not part of the war zone, so his proclamation, he couldn't say, my proclamation is now law in Maryland, and I free all the slaves in Maryland, because Maryland was not, there wasn't any battles going on.
So he really wasn't, that concerned about freeing the slave. He just wanted, of course, an excuse. Basically, you and I are going to disagree on this. I believe, of course, that there were other reasons that the Civil War was fought. I've heard the communists right here in my own community telling me how they were there working in in the United States in between 1860 and 1865. And of course, you remember the Communist Manifesto was written in 1848, and they were here working. What was their purpose? To centralize all power in Washington and to destroy this idea of states' rights, centralizing authority in preparation for this one world, first of all, an authoritarian society here and then throughout the world. But we won't solve that problem tonight, Eric. But I'd suggest the book,
The Creature from Jekyll Island.
Excellent book. It gives you a lot of background there that you won't get elsewhere.
Well, one of the comments I do have, though, I agree with you because communism looks for tension under the surface. And whether it's the slavery issue, whether it's the blacks against the whites, the rich against the poor, the Catholics against the Protestants, the Muslims against the Jews, the idea is they would look for tension under the surface, and they would go into a country and fan it into a flame and create a crisis, a terrible situation, and then everybody would be willing to let go of their rights and freedoms in order to solve this crisis. And so I'm sure, and I've read those books where, you know, the rich bankers in London saw the tension in America, and they said, how can we capitalize on this? And they wanted to stir it up to flames. But, you know, and even Lincoln, I've read his writings throughout his life, and he was very critical of slavery, you know, from the very beginning. He wrote a letter to his friend Joshua Speed, and he said, that one trip that you and I took down to New Orleans, and there were slaves that were on that ship. He says, that vision haunts me. And
well, I think everybody, I mean, every Christian would feel that this is morally repugnant and wrong. And certainly, Eric, the white Christians in the North, I mean, the abolitionist movement was really very, very strong. And they had an underground railway of smuggling slaves out, and they'd get into the North. And then, of course, the people in the South would say, well, that's my property. I want it back again. They'd have a trial. And of course, the people in the North would say, well, we don't agree with the law. We don't agree with the laws of this land. You don't have a right to have slaves. And so they'd free the slaves in the North. And you know, certainly there's no question slavery was wrong, but that was not, in my estimation, the primary reason. It was, as I say, if it were the primary reason, they would have had the Emancipation Proclamation day one of the war. And they waited until after the massive riots in the North, where over 2,000 people were slaughtered in New England because they didn't want to get involved in this genocidal war. We killed 500,000 Americans in this war. And in the South, there were a lot of the slaves who were fighting right alongside with the whites. And the free blacks in the South were fighting, you know, along with the whites. But you know, we never hear that part of the story, you know, the story of the War of Northern Aggression. But then, of course, that's what the Southerners call it.
Well, one of the points I would like to bring out is, you know, Jesus said, the wheat and the tares grow together until the harvest. And I have found that throughout history, you can trace two threads, greed and the gospel.
Right.
You have one group of people that are like, you know, the Mother Teresa's, the William Carey missionaries, the missionaries that start soup kitchens and hospital clinics and dig wells, and they risk their lives, they sacrifice to help other people. And those are the true Christians, because the word Christian means Christian. It means little Christ. In other words, somebody that's acting like Jesus. And then you have other people that they have the name of Christian, but their actions betray that they're not. And they're people that are motivated by greed. You know, William Carey and Adoniram Judson were missionaries to India and Burma. You know who their biggest opposition was? It wasn't the Burmese or the, you know, it was the East India Tea Company. They didn't want them to convert these people to Christianity because then they'd have to treat them as equals. They were motivated by greed, by business. In the Bahamas, the islands where they had sugar plantations, they had brought slaves over from Africa. The Moravian Christian missionaries came and worked amongst the slaves to get them to become Christian. Who was the opposition? It was the plantation owners, because they felt once these people become Christian, they'll have to treat them as equals. They won't be able to enslave them anymore. That was that greed. And so when people say, all the founders were evil slave owners, and they were. If that was Christian, I don't want anything to do with it. Well, hold on just a second. Yes, there were people like Richard Bassett who converted to Methodism, freed his slaves, paid them as hired labor, and would ride in the wagon with them to go to the church services. There were people that were truly motivated, and at the same time, you had other people that were, you can divide it into four categories, and if you think from north to south, the extreme north said, slavery's wrong, get rid of it now. The moderate north said, slavery's wrong, let's ease out of it over time. The moderate south said, slavery's wrong, but we got to live with it. It's been here for centuries. And the extreme south said, slavery's good, let's keep it. And that was the mix in the country. But you look at it, it was definitely Christians that started abolitionist societies that were like Charles Finney that started Oberlin College and graduated the first black from college. He was preaching against slavery and it was the Christians that stirred the country up to do something about it.
That's what I thought.
But certainly, there's always been a Christian force in America, and then there's always been that other force. You call it greed, and I'm sure some of it's greed, but I'm sure there's also really evil people
evil
out there.
Yes.
And of course, they're the ones, of course, who today we see them working. And
absolutely.
And this, at one time, we were predominantly Christian. I wish we were predominantly Christian today.
Well, one other point along those lines. Harry S. Truman, in his inaugural address, 1949, said, "We believe all men are created equal because they are created in the image of God." Now, again, all the presidents sworn to office with their hand upon what? A Bible. It wasn't a Quran, wasn't a Bhagavad Gita, it was a Bible. So when they mention God, they're referring to the Judeo-Christian God. But anyway, he says, because all men are created in the image of God. Well, if there is no God, then we're not created and we're not equal because some are more evolved than others. According to Darwin, Darwin was a racist. He wrote his Descent of Man, and he began to categorize, and he said, there are certain species of the human race in Africa that are inferior. Now, that's shocking, but that was what he wrote. And then the Dred Scott case in 1857, and I read it. It was a horrible thing. It says that, it literally said that Negroes are so far inferior they should be enslaved for their own benefit. I mean, that was just horrible, but that's the concept they had when they took God out, that we're equal. And then that influenced Margaret Sanger, who started Planned Parenthood, and she said that we needed to eliminate the human weeds from the human garden and eliminate genetically inferior people. And then that influenced Hitler, who said the Aryan German race was Ubermenschen, Superman, and he needed to eliminate inferior races from the human gene pool, and he considered gypsies and Jews there. And so all these horrible killings and enslavements take place. Why? If you do not believe that we're all created equal because we're created in the image of God. And so that's, to me, is one of the main reasons why it's important for America to be under God. Because, if there is no God, then we're not created and we're not equal.
We don't get back under God's blessing, but I don't think that God will ever bless this country again unless there's a revival, unless people turn back to him. Eric, thank you so much for calling.
Now, can you do me one quick favor?
What's that?
How do I respond when people throw up the Crusaders at me?
Oh, you just tell them that there was corruption in the church. That was a political thing.
Also,
they were entirely...
one of the things I point out is that in 636 A.D., the Muslims conquered Jerusalem. Jerusalem was ruled by the Byzantine Christians. They had been there for centuries. In 636, it was a four-month bloody siege, and the Muslims killed the Christians, drove them out, and the Crusades was a belated response to take back the land that originally belonged to the Christians. Spain waited 700 years to drive the Muslims out. So it was just taking back the land that the Muslims had taken away centuries earlier.
That's a good response. Eric, we're out of time. God bless. And Bill, thank you so much.
Hey, Eric, great questions. And I wrote a book on George Washington Carver. If you contact me or Dr. Stan, I'd love to get you a copy.
We actually have that book. We think it's a great book. Get your telephone number out quick.
Bill? 888-USA-WORD.
888-USA-WORD. What about a website?
Amerisearch.net. AmeriSearch, AmeriSearch.net. They can sign up for that American Minute. And I did email you the file, Dr. Stan, if you want to put it on your website.
God bless you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, and thanks for the questions.
Good night.
The callers that called in.